Hello, everyone. Tom Slater here, editor of Spiked. We're going to get into this week's episode in just one moment. But before that, I just want to let you all know about our Christmas donation drive. Yes, it's that time of year again where the snow is falling and the Christmas lights are twinkling and your favourite pro-freedom, pro-democracy magazine is hassling you to donate money. But as we ask our readers and our listeners and our YouTube viewers to dig deep for us this Christmas to keep us fighting the good fight into 2023, you can rest assured that your money is going to great use. It's been a hell of a year. The world's been turned upside down once again, but Spiked has continued to make the case for freedom, for more democracy, for common sense in an increasingly deranging age. And there's a lot that I think we can really be proud of this year. We've continued to grow our magazine, our stable of writers now spanning great new up-and-comers, as well as some real journalistic legends. We also got into the book publishing game this year. We published Joanna Williams' brilliant How Woke One, and we've got another book slated for release next year, which I'll be very excited to announce to you all soon. And we wouldn't have been able to do any of this without you guys, without our generous readers, listeners, and viewers who really do fund our work. Contrary to media rumour, we are not lavishly funded by dark money, although if you do know anyone, please send them my way. If it wasn't for your support and, of course, the incredibly hardworking tiny team that we have here at Spiked who produce the articles and the podcast and the videos day in, day out, if it wasn't for all of that, then Spiked wouldn't still be here 20 years on, not just surviving, but thriving. I mean, when I first joined Spiked about 10 years ago, we were reaching hundreds of thousands of people a month. We're now reaching millions of people each month, and we really couldn't do that without you and your support. If anything, that support is more important to us than ever, because while Spiked is going from strength to strength in so many ways, you know, we're also coming up against obstacles in this very censorious climate that we find ourselves in, that we rail against. Just as an example, you know, even as Spiked's readership and our traffic climbs, we find that our ad revenue goes down because more and more ad agencies are blacklisting dissenting voices like ours because they come under pressure from all the usual suspects who want a media that only reflects their own views and prejudices back at them. So as we go into 2023, a big focus for us is to really grow the pool of readers and viewers and listeners who donate to us as little or as much as they can in order to, again, keep us writing the articles, making the videos and making the podcasts. And alongside that, we've got a lot of really exciting plans for 2023 as well. New features, new writers, new ideas, just to push our message as far across the globe as is humanly possible. So if you can afford it, please do consider digging deep this Christmas and donating to Spiked. You can do so by going to spiked-online.com/donate. And there's also a special offer on at the moment. So to those who donate a one-off donation of £30 or more, you will get 1 year's membership to Spiked supporters, which is a real steal because it's usually £50 for the year's membership. Spiked supporters, if you've been living under a rock, is where it's at. It's our thriving donor community where you can access all kinds of exclusive perks. You can get access to exclusive events with Spiked writers and special guests. Put your questions to people like Brendan O'Neill, as well as guests like Rod Liddell or Toby Young and Lionel Shriver. You can access our comment section, which is for Spiked supporters only. And of course, you can get discounts to all the books we put out and all the merchandise we sell in our shop. So once again, if you can donate, please do go to spiked-online.com/donate to do so. And I just want to say on behalf of everyone at Spiked, thank you so much for all of your support this year. We really do appreciate it. And we hope you all have a brilliant Christmas and a brilliant new year. Now, on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the end of cash, why smoking can save lives, and the hysteria over Elon Musk. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm all right. We've got a bit of a virus.
Not COVID, I hope.
No. It's much worse than it.
And we're delighted to be joined once again on the show. His third time on the show, I believe. Stand-up comedian, host of the brilliant podcast What Most People Think, Jeff Norcott. Jeff, thanks for joining us again today.
I won't lie, lads. I was out having a couple of beers last night and I did consider making something up because I was past the four beer mark and I thought, But you know what? I'm going to just see what comes out. I think I should. And if it, the problem is, if it goes well, I'll then need to drink more for my career. And that's not necessarily a problem, let's be honest.
And speaking of your career, you're on tour at the moment, or you're going to be on tour in the new year, were you saying?
Yeah, just got a bunch of work in progress shows that are going up. We're doing them in April, May and early June. Because for the last tour, it was coming out the back end of COVID. And it was that weird thing that comedians always benefit from, is everyone having experienced the same thing. So like you can talk about school or having a mum and dad. Well, I mean, not everyone has a mum and dad, but... God, there you go. I've already been exclusionary and triggering. But you know, COVID, a lot of comedians felt like they came into those tours post-COVID, one with a lot of zeal to be on stage. And so, you know, with accessible reference points. So I really want to have a good lead into this. So we're doing 14 shows in the spring of next year. And they'll be good. You know what I mean? They'll be up to a very... I just want a bit of latitude to try, you know, fine-tune the last bits. And the ticket prices are a bit cheaper as well. So, you know, just go on Live Nation or anywhere my social media is.
Brilliant. And anyone who hasn't seen Jeff live should definitely go. He's fantastic. So we're going to start off with something that you've written about, Jeff, today. And it's the move towards a cashless society, a contactless society. You wrote a very funny and insightful piece about it for The Spectator. This is a sort of topic that animates a certain kind of very online right winger. But in your piece, you talk about how even as a kind of self-identifying centrist dad, there are things about the move towards getting rid of cash that concern you. So do you want to talk us through that piece a little bit, some of the points you made in it?
Yeah, it occurred to me. I was going out to Dublin to do a couple of shows there. And yes, they do book me. people will probably be surprised to hear. I was going out of Dublin and then I left my debit card in the departure gate. But I just thought, well, I'll get there and I'll sort it out, you know. And it wasn't quite as easy to sort out as I thought. And there were problems with sort of withdrawing money in Dublin. You know, it's just one of those modern things that if you've got money in the bank, you think you'll be able to sort it out. And it wasn't as easy as I thought. And then when I got back to the UK, my bank sort of messed up the first dispatch of the new debit card. So I was having to just withdraw a lot of cash and just, you know, sort of pay for things analog. But then I just found this sort of like string of places that were just sort of slightly sanctimoniously saying, actually, we're cashless. And there was something about the way they said it really aggravated me, but like it was some sort of trend or some hipster, you know, like kombucha or something, you know. And I thought, this is bad, because I could see that there were some places, you know, like I went to the Ministry of Sound, believe it or not, at my age, for a daytime clubbing event. And I thought, well, most people here are going to have debit cards, right? But if they ever have bingo at the Ministry of Sound, you know, not it's going to be a different proposition. I just thought, on the one hand, there's the practical element of it for people who simply, you know, don't have bank accounts or don't want to have bank accounts. It's not an unreasonable thing to not wish to have a bank account. And again, it's quite exclusionary, really. And I think that, I suppose the point that kept coming up in my mind is we've had cash for thousands of years, right? And if we are just getting rid of it, I think it'd be a real shame if it was one of those things that just drifted away on the breeze without even a discussion, because that's what it feels like is happening.
And you also mentioned the kind of civil liberties implications, I suppose, or just the ability for all of that, just everything to be tracked and how... You don't need to be a conspiracy theorist to be concerned about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, just the fact that every single thing has a footprint. Now, I am probably one of those people that lives a fairly law-abiding life. I'm not really concerned about tech giants knowing a lot about me, but there are people that are, and it's not an unreasonable wish. I mean, there's this kind of fatuous argument that people make in response. We go, have you got a smartphone where you're getting tracked? And you go, okay, I'm allowed to have a point in this debate where I come alive. I can't, you know, be... They're right at the outset of it. But I think that the cash is such a fundamental thing. And it's not just about illegality. It's just it's reasonable to not think the state should be able to, one, know everything you're doing, and two, have a built-in means by which to sanction individuals.
And what do you think about all of this, Chris? Are you concerned about a cashless society? Is it something you thought much about?
Yeah, well, I haven't thought about it a lot. But yeah, now and again, I have. I like cash a lot. In fact, one of my tips in life is always to have lots of cash in your wallet, because I think you always feel a lot happier, even if you don't really spend it, which you can, like Jeff says, often you can't these days, or you don't need to anyway. That always cheers me up, having 200 quid in my wallet. Some people say you might get mugged and that. Oh, yeah. Well, you might.
Especially now that you're advertising it on this podcast.
Yeah.
If you see Chris, there's a good chance he's got 200 quid on him. So.
Yeah, like one of those security vans that says, this man is emptied overnight.
I've got some dry cleaning to pick up today, actually, and the dry cleaners only take cash. That was quite surprising when I saw the little sign saying they only take cash. And you do get quite a few places still, my neck of the woods anyway, say we only take cash. And you do wonder why. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, Jeff says he's not sticking up for criminals or anything, but you do wonder if there's a bit of tax dodging going on, which I'm not really opposed to. And I do worry about, you know, drug dealers and so on, how they're going to survive in a post-cash world. I guess they could use crypto.
True.
But, you know, it's quite unreliable, quite unstable, as we found in recent years. So I'm very much in favor of cash, but I think it will more or less die out. I don't think it will probably completely die out. And I have to say, I don't really go with this thing about, oh, well, what about people who haven't got bank accounts? Why wouldn't you have a bank account, really? Really? What reason is it to not have a bank account?
Don't you have to have an address?
Yeah. Well, you need to have had an address at some point. Yeah. I mean, but that's not a huge ask.
Some people just don't want to have bank accounts.
Well, all right. But in that case, you're not going to be able to buy things in lots of shops. I mean, you know, actions have consequences.
I thought libertarians are all about living off the grid. You know, you want to have a compound and...
Well, yeah, if you want to live off the grid, then maybe you won't be able to buy coffee in Starbucks, you know, because they're only accepting, you know, cards, and that is their right. It's a bit like this voter ID debate, you know, not to digress onto another issue, but... Yeah, the argument there is, oh, well, what about people who haven't got a photo ID? Well, get a photo ID. I mean, come on, how many people? The vast majority of people have got a driving license. The vast majority of people have got a passport. If you haven't got one of those two things, you're a bit weird. You've obviously got a right to be weird and you've got a right to vote, but you can get another photo ID. Join a library. You know, we're not asking a huge amount. These seem like very feeble excuses to me.
But the cash is so fundamental to how you operate as an individual on a day. That's why I think it stands outside of some of the things that you're mentioning there. And, you know, I suppose, and God, I mean, if I bring up the Canadian truckers, I'm now sounding way more sort of Russell Brand than I intended to. But, you know, there was a situation there where people were managed heavily by the state. And that's, you know, it's also, you know, I suppose people on the right are often accused of overusing the phrase thin end of the wedge. It's always not where it is now. Is potentially where it ends up. Having said that, you know, I don't, and I said this in the article, I'm not one of these people that thinks this is a coordinated global economic forum type. You know, I don't think any of the people involved, I don't think Jeremy Hunt is that guy. You know, I think it's a succession of events which were sort of turbocharged by COVID. And a lot of companies just went, oh, it's a real arse ache to bank money. Let's not bank money. But it surprises me really because of, you know, debit card charges all have various levels of charges.
Yeah, right.
Applied to them. I don't think going to the bank once a week was that much of a ball ache, you know, in comparison to saving anything from 1-3%, you know, on your transactions.
Yeah, that is very true. I mean, that really adds up. You know, Visa and MasterCard make an incredible amount of money and the banks make an incredible amount.
And Amex is ridiculous.
Right, yeah. Amex, you say in the article in Dublin, they don't really take Amex. And it's kind of surprising anyone does because it's like 3 or 4, maybe even 5% for nothing, really. I mean, all you're doing is buying something. Why? Yeah. Amex is weird. It kind of benefits people who have the card to some extent, but not the people who are selling.
Doesn't
the
it then put a lot of power in there? You know, if cash is essentially obsolete, is that what is their motivation to not charge a hell of a lot more?
Yeah, no, I mean, basically, Jeff, I do agree with you. I just don't think it's going to disappear anytime soon. And even if even if the government literally withdrew cash, we could still use dollars. I mean, currencies, you can use anything as a currency, as we've seen with these ridiculous cryptocurrencies,
which is a whole other kettle of fish, which would also anger the sorts of conspiracy theorists Jeff was talking about there. Jeff, you mentioned the thin end of the wedge, and whilst we're talking about the thin end of the wedge, it's a good place to move on to what's going on in New Zealand in relation to smoking, because Chris, for a very long time you've talked about how the plain packaging or any of these kind of piece by piece restrictions, it's all heading in one direction, it's prohibition, and people would often snort at that. They say you're being alarmist or whatever, but what New Zealand seemed to have slated for is essentially to make New Zealand smoke-free, as they put it in their euphemistic way, but yeah, it's about getting rid of it entirely. I mean, we've seen plans like this mooted over here, but it actually seems like they're going ahead with it. Do you want to tell us a bit more about what it's going to look like?
Yeah, they are fully going ahead with it. So they're saying that anybody born after January the 1st, 2009 will never be able to buy cigarettes. So the people who are 14 basically now will be the last people who can ever buy cigarettes in New Zealand. And that's got a lot of coverage. And it's been interesting to see the nature of the coverage, which has basically been either neutral or kind of approving of this. And it is prohibition. The thing that's kind of gone under the radar, which is way more important than this kind of incremental age-based prohibition, is the fact they're going to take nearly all the nicotine out of cigarettes. So it's not like, you know, people who are already smoking will be able to smoke for the rest of their lives and they don't need to worry. They won't at all. They will effectively not be able to buy cigarettes. I mean, a cigarette with hardly any nicotine, and they are going to bring it down to like 5% of what's in it now. So essentially, it's completely unsatisfying. There's no point buying cigarettes unless you just want to kill yourself and you're not interested in enjoying them.
All the bad stuff, none of the good stuff.
Yeah, a really labor-intensive form of suicide.
Right, yeah. You can vape as well and have some patches on and have the cigarette just for the tar. That's the real thing. That's a real prohibition in effect. And they're going to do that very, very soon. So effectively, cigarettes are going to be banned within the next 2 or 3 years in New Zealand. And that will almost certainly have all the predictable consequences of, you know, black markets, robberies and smuggling and general criminality, and hopefully it will fail so badly that it'll scare other countries off from doing it. But they have got a number of advantages in New Zealand, particularly in terms of its geography. It's got, and it's also a small population. Only about 8% of people in New Zealand smoke now. So it's not a massive market, even for tobacco smuggling industry. Having said that, they're already seeing a lot of tobacco smuggling in New Zealand just because they've got really high taxes. So anyhow, the point is, this is prohibition, and it's not even incremental prohibition. It is actual prohibition. It's going to happen very soon. And what gets me more than anything about it is, like you say, Tom, it's been pretty obvious that this is the end goal. Okay. Mm. And if you look at surveys going back decades, there've always been about 20 or 30% of people who just think that cigarettes should be banned outright. And that's a perfectly, you know, reasonable position to take. You can make that case, you know. But the anti-smoking movement have never been officially part of that 20 or 30%, you know. And they've always denied it. And I've been in debates with these people down the years about all sorts of different policies, smoking ban, display ban, plain packaging. And you call them prohibitionists. And they flat out deny it. And they say, well, it's hysteria. Of course we're not trying to ban cigarettes. That would be ridiculous. All this kind of stuff. We're just trying to regulate the industry. We're just trying to protect young people. And it's always, always been, from the outset, it's always been incredibly disingenuous and dishonest. And they were just waiting for their moment when smoking rates were so low that they weren't going to get real kickback. And in New Zealand, like, if you're rich and white, the chances of you being a smoker are almost zero. I mean, it's incredibly low rates of smoking amongst people on high incomes and white people. But the Maori smoking rate is like 30%. It's like incredibly high. So there's, I think, a kind of a racist element to this. I guess these people would say it's positive discrimination because they're helping the Maoris more, but that's massively disingenuous too. So, I mean, all I'm saying is, it's the dishonesty of the movement for decades that gets me. And they flat out deny that they're prohibitionists right up until the moment that they bring in prohibition, at which point they go, actually, this is a very sensible thing. And it's really the only logical, you know, conclusion to this.
What do you make of this, Jeff?
I mean, I said a while ago, and it, you know, it's slightly tongue in cheek, but it was during COVID that I thought Jacinda Ardern would be the world's first woke dictator. Right? And it's sort of a joke to allude to, say, but I wonder if there's something in it now, because, you know, I've been listening to this series about dictators, and there's always that thing at the beginning is that there's something in them that will never be satisfied. So, you know, if you did ban smoking completely, that feeling would just apply to something else. It would never stop there, because it hasn't stopped. And Chris is right, you know, whether packaging or advertising, they've minimized it to the point where it's almost irrelevant, really, as a number. And I find it hard because I really don't like smoking. I grew up in a house where all my family smokes. It used to wind me up. Like, I hate defending it. But this idea that you can sort of withdraw something popular because of a set of values that you hold, you know, and be quite aggressive about it. I don't, you know, I would stand up against that generally, because it won't be the last thing. You know, as you've seen, there's already, you know, it's happening with vaping. And I just wish all these pricks would go to church, to be honest. I think, yeah.
And also how the kind of anti-smoking playbook becomes the playbook for everything, like you say. Like, you know, we're having conversations about plain packaging for fast food and stuff. That would have sounded completely crackers, like even about 5 years ago.
Well, you could eat crackers, though. I mean, they would be allowable.
Yeah, sure. Depending on what you put on them, but I'm sure it would be fine.
Right. But despite the fact that we now know for a fact that we end with prohibition with the anti-smoking movement, right? It's actually happening in New Zealand, and other countries are talking about the same thing.
That'd be a really crap speakeasy, though, wouldn't it? People just smoking Benson and Hedges. They have none of the glamour of the US era with alcohol.
Even though we've got like proof that the libertarian slippery slope people were correct on this, if you make the same argument about alcohol or gambling, people still come back with, "Don't be ridiculous. Of course I'm not going to do that." Despite the fact that there has actually been prohibition of alcohol. 100 years ago, there still is prohibition of alcohol in various countries around the world. Gambling was banned until the 1960s in this country. It's not like these things never happen. And it's hardly as if the world is generally going in a more liberalizing direction, right? So it's perfectly plausible that sugary drinks or certain alcoholic beverages or certain types of gambling are going to be banned. And it's exactly the trajectory we're on.
Do you remember Layla? Is it Layla Moran?
Yeah.
She's a Lib Dem. I never really know any Lib Dems ever.
So if you do know one, it's usually for bad reasons, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Layla Moran is probably the most famous Lib Dem, but that's sort of like, that's not a high tariff, is it, for being the most famous Lib Dem? She's the showstopper. She's box office. But she spoke about liberalism as freedom from. And she literally just redefined it from being freedom to do things to freedom from things. And there is a philosophical argument that you can make there about, for people to be. But it always ends up sounding dictatorial to me. Like the moment you start saying, for people to be free to live their lives from fear, other people must be stopped. That always goes down the same route. And it's been really interesting listening to this podcast about dictators, because the thing that comes out, particularly with communism as well, it's such a well-worn cliche about the road tale is paved with good intentions. But all of this, I mean, do you remember that film, the 12 Monkeys, when the guy smokes a cigarette, which is 90% filter? And we all thought, hilarious. I think that if New Zealand still had that in 10 years, the libertarians would have scored a big victory, because the direction of travel is much more restrictive than that even.
And it's interesting that people don't see it as authoritarian anymore. Like, it's just seen as sticking up for grubby-fingered people who are the kind of from the wrong side of the tracks. It's a very unattractive kind of cause to hold up, as Chris has for many years. But it's so authoritarian, like, just to say that this habit that you have, which at this point, particularly with smoking bans and so on, really doesn't impact anyone but you and the people immediately around you. And yet the willingness to sort of take it away. And like, without wanting to generalize or broaden this out too much, that sort of illiberal liberalism, which sort of really defines someone like Ardern or Trudeau or Biden even, like it seems to be getting more intense on several different fronts. It's not just the lifestyle stuff, it's everything,
Well, it's very, to use the language of that side of the debate, it's very gaslighting. Mm. And they move bit by bit where, it always starts off where we're trying to do the right thing, as though the right thing isn't in itself a subjective idea, and it really just bit by bit just takes away agency. I was thinking this is sort of related but not, but I was thinking about being frustrated with the Conservatives, and you as a lot of people are, you reassess, well, what is my political orientation? What is it that makes me right wing? Am I still right wing and stuff? And then I was thinking about just gritting the roads, right? Like, if every single person had a bag of grit, and when it snowed you did the bit just outside your house, it would be fine, right? It would work. That system would absolutely work. But people almost want to consolidate the management of their lives into centralized places. But the point about gritting your own drive is there's something really good about that. There's something really healthy about attending to your own situation. But I don't think people in this country have sort of, because as Chris says, these things are done so gradually and incrementally, I don't think that people realize that even in the space of a 20-year period, how much the culture has shifted towards the sort of microscopic management of behaviour. So gritting roads, that's the council have been doing that for a long time. But it's just an example of how you see the world. I think that there's something morally healthy in going, that is my job to do that. That is my responsibility. And by us all doing that, it will help make the world better. Whereas, left-wing people, let's just pay a bit more council tax and they handle it. It's always, the answer is always centralising things and paying more tax. And inevitably, the person that pays more tax, it should never be them either. So they don't really ever... They want things to be better, but they don't actually assert a role for themselves at any stage of how it becomes better.
Let's stay on the topic of smoking for a second, Chris, because recently on Spiked, you published your masterpiece on this particular topic, which is the banter hypothesis, as you've called it, the question of whether or not smoking was actually effectively a kind of prophylactic against COVID. It's something you've been following for a very long time, collecting dozens of studies. You've put it all in one place for us. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that, where we're at with that whole big burning scientific debate that everyone's been following very closely?
Yes, because this podcast has been the leading source of news on this important issue. The rest of the MSM have been turning a blind eye. Rod Little actually mentioned it in the Sunday Times last week, which was nice, but that's literally the only time anyone mentioned it for a long time. So the evidence that people who smoke are significantly less likely to get COVID-19. I've been tracking all the studies that look at this for some time now, and I finally got to 100. So I've been listing them on my blog. Finally got to 100. I thought, well, that's a good time to stop, because 87 of them showed a statistically significant reduction in risk of catching COVID among smokers, which seems fairly compelling. And it's not as if the other 13 strongly go in the other direction. They're mostly just kind of mixed results, really. So I wrote this up for Spiked, my final word on the matter, really, as a matter of interest. But also, it's quite interesting that if you Google this particular area, you just see the same websites that basically deny it, some of which are 2.5 years old, just the WHO going like, well, we don't think there's any evidence for this, or there's not enough evidence for it, or whatever. Or obfuscating and saying, well, smokers who get COVID are in a worse state as a result. Well, that may be true, but that's not the question at stake. The question is whether they are less likely to get it in the first place. And I noted that my initial article about this way back in 2020 was flagged as fake news on Facebook. Now, I'm not on Facebook, so I don't know exactly what that looks like. Someone has told me it being flagged as fake news. But then this week, I found that an organization called Logically, which is Facebook's official fact-checking partner, had written something about my more recent article for Spiked, which flagged it as misleading, based entirely on like completely unspecified, you know, possible flaws in the studies. Well, there's always possible flaws in epidemiological studies, obviously, and relied very heavily on the two or three websites that always come at the top of the search listings every time you type in tobacco and COVID or smoking and COVID or whatever. It's just the same stuff every time, and none of it like rebuts the evidence or even really mentions the evidence properly. So this fact-checking is incredibly lame and almost confirms what I say in the article, which is that people have been, anyone who like casually searches for this will find really misleading stuff that just kind of ignores the evidence completely. And this official fact-checker for Facebook, who presumably now has led to my article being flagged as fake news on Facebook again. I don't know if anyone's on Facebook, let me know what that looks like. And his so-called fact-checking was a load of rubbish.
It's just ridiculous. And you realise as well, they get these kind of fact-checkers from some kind of third-party organisation. They have no idea about this topic. They've never read about any of it until they had to have a look at your piece. They Google around a bit and then they hold forth on what is true and false.
Yeah, I mean, fact checkers can be quite good. There are some good ones.
It just felt misleading. They should have flagged it as inconvenient. Because I, you know, for me, like as someone who dislikes smoking, the idea that smoking could have benefits, I find it really uncomfortable. But if that's the truth, that's the world we should deal in. But there's the comic side of my brain actually quite likes the perverseness of that nature whereby you could end up, you know, those old adverts where you're going, smoking is good for the lungs. It clears you out, mental in particular. Smoke, if you want to avoid COVID, smoke heavily, especially if you're pregnant. You know, like that, that idea is fucking hilarious to me.
Yeah, obviously I take no pleasure at all from finding a positive health implication from smoking, but the facts are the facts.
Exactly.
And yeah.
Well, the guy that is vaping his way through a cough, I think that your position is clear.
Yeah, I'd be in a much worse state if I wasn't vaping and drinking my way through this flu-y thing I've got. No, the fact checkers are generally very good. I don't like that, you know, that a lot of nutters are kind of think that all fact checking is some sort of conspiracy and something's not true unless it's been described as untrue by a fact checker. A lot of them are very good. Full Facts are a great organization. The Reuters fact checks are pretty good. Even Channel 4's fact checks are quite good, but the BBC one not so good and tend to be a little bit, you know,
it's BBC fact check is dreadful. We had a run in with them over like the free speech on campus thing,
right?
When we used to do a lot of research on that, they were saying there's only been like 5 cases, and you thought, again, if you just spent more than 10 minutes on Google, you'd know that was complete nonsense.
Yeah, so I mean, who will fact check the fact checkers? It becomes the issue, and just because you call yourself a fact checker, it doesn't mean that that's the final word on the issue.
I often wonder what sort of inspires them to fact check. I reckon they just get really fucking annoyed by something, yeah. You know? Just they're like us, they're just on social media I think that the one that they did recently that I particularly enjoyed, and you, it would have come up, I'm sure, with you guys a lot, is this, well, they spent they wasted 37 billion quid on Track and Trace. Yeah. Well, you know, there's no such thing as Track and Trace. And I've always thought, if you could show me how you could even corruptly spend 37 billion quid on essentially people working out of a call center. I mean, I would love to have seen that call center. It would probably look like the head office of fucking Twitter. Do you know what I mean? People, free lunches, people, you know, people who are operating the phones just arriving on Bentleys. It would have almost been like a Brewster's Million style challenge, yeah, right, to have spent that money. And that's what I find so odd, is that people that share the Track and Trace myth are like kind of bright people. And you go, if you just thought about it like for a second, it's not possible to spend that money. There's absolutely a debate to be had about the efficacy of test and trace. Trace, did we test too much? You know, that's another question that those kind of people never are, you know, ask. But Track and Trace, it was just one of those things that embedded in the popular conscience very early. And then there was a Labour MP, I can't remember who it was, and he repeated it. And then Full Fact got stuck in. I really enjoyed it. And his original tweet, I mean, as is classically the case, his original tweet was like 30,000 likes. And then he sort of said, oh, it does seem like I may have been talking utter shit, you know, 12 likes. Mm. And still didn't delete the original one. And I think that I find that when a lot of people on the left have been the ones making the biggest noises about fake news and the threats to our democracy, and how often, you know, the moment that they're challenged on this issue, they don't sort of live by the same standards. And I guess what they're thinking probably is, well, it's you fight fire with fire. We, you know, but that really, that's not an argument. You know, saying, well, we lie because they lied. You're just another liar, really. And so I think that Full Fact, they typically do a good job and they seem reasonably non-partisan.
So let's go on to another criminally undercovered story, and that's Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter. We haven't really talked about it much on the podcast before, but obviously it's kind of flushed out all of the usual arguments, not just about big tech censorship, but free speech in general. I mean, the general take seems to be that he, in trying to, at least this is what he's saying he's doing, kind of liberalize Twitter, he's ushering in far-right extremism and so on and so forth. So there's so much we could talk about here. There's also been the Twitter files recently, the kind of journalistic writing up of what happened, particularly in 2020, around suppressing the Hunter Biden story, kicking Trump off of Twitter and so on. So there's lots to talk about. But Jeff, in general, what have you made of the whole Elon Musk Twitter takeover thing? Is it just a kind of Twitter bubble story that everyone loves talking about, or do you feel like it's quite significant?
I do think that it is a bit of a bubble story. I think billionaires in general, I don't think the public give much of a toss about billionaires. We've seen them as sort of oddity, right? And I think that when I've worked on kind of topical shows, there's two things that I always think are they tend to suggest as stories but never play out in the record because the public aren't interested. One of them is space travel. For some reason, the public just don't give a fuck about space travel, right? And billionaires, I just think people just, they don't despise them. They just see them as this odd thing. I think that there is a resentment that Musk has made noises, some of which don't sound very left-wing. But in that, what there is a tacit admittance of the power of Twitter. And you're sort of admitting it was a bit biased before, because if it was changing, well, we're changing from what? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the same argument that you get when the governance of the BBC gets called into question. Why is it that people that get most exercised about its role reducing or disappearing altogether all seem to hold roughly the same opinions? It's because there is a lean within that media organisation. I think it's madness, actually, people that are progressives leaving Twitter. I think this would be the worst time to leave Twitter, because even if it shuffles a little bit right, it will still disproportionately signal boost progressive ideas. It will, because just by sheer numbers game, the people that are online are more likely to be of a certain age and more of a political disposition. So the real issue that I think that no one can shy away from now is that this thing can be manipulated. And it was manipulated one way before, and now it's getting manipulated the other way. So we need to reckon with that fact. We know that newspapers have a bias. All organisations have a bias. But we sort of pretended to ourselves for a while that social media was this free marketplace, this of ideas, and evidently it wasn't. And it was fairly strictly managed. And I've got to say, like, the lack of coverage, I know that Twitter is a bubble idea, but the lack of coverage for some of the revelations about, you know, the Twitter files. There was one sort of information dump, and I thought, well, this is going to have to be on like the BBC website. And the only Twitter story on the BBC website was about the welfare of Twitter staff. Like, some of them were being asked to stay overnight, and it had a picture of like some bunk bed that they were sleeping in. I go, okay. I mean, that is a story, I'm not sure it's the story.
It was interesting. I think the weekend that the first Twitter Files thing was published, I think even the New York Times, this is, you know, America's newspaper of record, the two stories they had were about 2 days later. One of them was about Trump's reaction to it, because he said that the Constitution should be suspended in response to it. I don't really know why. And the other one was about the kind of the debate around it. You know, is this journalist just doing PR for Elon Musk and so on and so forth? And again, here, like listening to the radio this morning, again, it's about Elon Musk and his character and all this sort of stuff. The refusal to take it seriously is really weird, because
they're obsessed with him, honestly.
They're, like you say, they're obsessed with the billionaire, with the character, with this supposedly nefarious individual. But the substance of what he's doing and what has been revealed for him taking this over has been completely missed, despite the fact, as you say, Jeff, it's just any claim that the kind of liberal left or the woke left had to, you know, we don't really have any power, we don't really have any clout. People point at us and suggest that we're running things. How could we possibly? We're not, you know, running the world. And yet the kind of soft power, which can feel quite hard at times when you're kicking presidents off of the internet and so on, is tremendous. And you see it in those files, them just openly discussing, well, Trump is essentially, at one point they're saying, well, he is essentially like a fascist, so we need to do something about it, you know.
Well, I mean, just one thing quickly before Chris comes in, is there was one piece of information that was sort of signal boosted by people on the left, was that they found that right-wing politicians and right-wing news stories were given more coverage by Twitter or social media, which certainly on the face of it seemed to fly against what we're saying here. But I thought this, you know, on a raw numbers basis, the reason that is because people quote tweet. They say, look at what this idiot has said. I mean, like the Daily Mail, the amount of traffic that they get, I would say on social media, is the overwhelming majority is people sharing images or kind of screenshots of their front page will be people because they want to tell you what they're opposed to. That's like 90% of like social political discourse on social media is, look at, this is what I hate. People constantly. So naturally, I think that if you were to actually go in forensically and go, all right, how many of those things were shared in a positive way? I didn't fully trust that as a counter to what was being said by Musk.
Chris, what do you think about the whole Musk phenomenon?
Well, on paper, it's not a good thing that, you know, the public square is owned by one billionaire, but in practice, it seems to be working out so far. As far as I can see, you know, the guy believes in free speech. I know he's been controversial because he's kicked a few people off, but apparently only for a day or maybe a week at the most, and supposedly only because they were doxing his whereabouts, which is against their terms and conditions. So, you know, I'm a bit uncomfortable with the potential for him to suddenly, you know, do lots of weird things. And he has been saying a few weird things recently, particularly with regards to Fauci and COVID and stuff like that.
He's been a bit red-pilled, isn't he? There's no two ways about it.
Well, we could all do without that. It's like, you want to believe if there is going to be this singular owner of something as important as Twitter, you want to believe that they're fairly sober-minded. So when someone's essentially tweeting like a bored like computer programmer who just wants to wind people up, you know, I don't think that's helpful. I think that's what makes people on the left nervous. And I do understand that is when he seems, I guess, a bit trolly, I guess, and is just doing things for shits and giggles.
Yeah, but see, I don't mind that. In a way, I think that's the best thing about him, because he comes across as a genuine user of the platform, you know what I mean? And he clearly spends a bit too much time on 4chan for a guy in his position and his age, really. But yeah, I don't mind that. He shows that he's into it. And he's not like he's, you know, he might be saying some weird things about, you know, arrest Fauci or whatever, but he's not banning people who say the opposite. So he's just a character, and there aren't enough characters in public life anymore. There's nowhere near enough eccentrics knocking around. Everything's so boring, and I think that having some guy like him who's slightly unhinged but basically I think well-meaning is a net positive.
I do trust his motivation. I do think that he saw something wrong and wishes to address it, and I do agree to an extent that in an age of Sunak versus Starmer, I mean, and a lot of people, so it's become almost like a trope on the left to say, look, I actually want boring now. You know, I want boring. I go, all right, you know, I think that there are aspects of Boris that were too charismatic, but I don't, you know, when I see Sunak and Starmer go up against each other, and I do think that there'll be like a sort of fourth horseman of the boring apocalypse, is that if Hunt has to face Starmer, when they are palpably the same fucking bloke in a different mirror, I don't know what will happen there. You know, like when you're like in those films, like when you see you hear echoes from the metaverse in these Marvel films. That'll be one of those odd moments where things start to fragment, and then there'll be some Inception type moment where the floor becomes the ceiling and stuff. So you know, and then I guess there is an argument for it needed to become less exciting. I suppose there is a space for social media for a disruptor.
Definitely. We're fast running out of time, so we're just going to get to our postbag section where people send in their questions.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
We've got one here from Alex Dale, friend of the show. Does the team have any New Year's resolutions, especially nanny state-related ones? Like someone's going to take up heroin in the new year, I don't know. But Jeff, any New Year's resolutions or any kind of nanny state-related ones?
Not really. I mean, if anything, it's the opposite, but it's just a very personal thing. Is in COVID, I started drinking a can of Diet Coke every single day because I just thought I like it, so I'm going to do it, and it sort of takes away a bit of the misery. But I don't like being an addict to anything. I don't like being a slave to it. You know, it's almost like the opposite. You know, I'm at liberty to do what I want, but I feel like I'm not at liberty currently to not have a can of Diet Coke at lunch. But there's a really interesting advert, because Diet Coke are aware of... People really hate Diet Coke, by the way. People's relationship with aspartame is fucking hilarious to me, because they're so exercised about it. They think that it can cause... And every so often, they do a check on it, and it comes back the same, which is if you don't have too much of it, like most things, it's fine. But Diet Coke have become aware of this, and their campaign now is based around, like, if you want it, you should have it. I think that's genius, because that's the exact emotion I go... I mean, obviously, you know, if they did that with other things, you know, like with alcohol, that might be a bit more controversial, you know, or if certain kind of like opiate painkillers became legal in the UK and they said, if you want it, we should have it. That's potentially problematic. But yeah, I'm going to try and cut down. I'm going to try and cut down my Diet Coke intake.
Do you not prefer Coke Zero, Jeff?
No. And you know why? Because it tastes so much like Coke, it makes me suspicious. I don't feel like that could be right. It's ridiculously... It even has a sense of a sugary taste in your mouth, that weird powdery sort of essence that's sometimes left on your teeth after an old-fashioned Coke. So, yeah, it's very counterintuitive, the reason I don't like Coke Zero.
Because it's nicer.
No, do you know what? I've drunk Diet Coke so long. I think it goes well. I think it goes really well with standard lunch foods.
There you go, the kind of classic meal deal sort of, you know, situation. What about you, Chris? You got any New Year's resolutions?
No, I don't really believe in them. I don't see that. You know, if you want to make a change, you can do it any time, you know, any time of the year. And I don't particularly want to make a change. I don't know, if I was in New Zealand, I might take up smoking. Do you not think maybe some people will do that? You can see this door is about to close. Wouldn't you go, well, might as well.
Time to give it a go.
It's only got 2 years before they ban it. I might as well start smoking. I think I'd get back on the fags if the government said, like, from 2025, we're going to ban cigarettes. And I'd like to think that most of the country will be with me.
There are some aspects of smoking where the only time I've considered it is when it went to a tenner a box and people were still buying them. I was like, Jesus, this must be good. and it suddenly becomes such a sort of countercultural thing to do. I mean, like when I look at like, I mean, obviously, I don't think young people should smoke, but when you see a young person who smokes rather than vapes, you're like, you're an interesting human. Like, there's so many reasons for you not to have done that. I mean, vaping's been made so easy with the single-use disposables now. The fact that they've gone, no, you know, if smoking's been in my family for years, we've always been smokers. It's almost like being Jewish or something. You know, we just, that's who we are.
Yeah, it's an incredible product, isn't it? They haven't been able to advertise it for 20 years. It's really expensive and it kills you. And yet it still virtually sells itself. Still millions of people, even in this country, are smoking cigarettes. That's how good cigarettes are. That's what a quality product is. Needs no promotion.
That's a good slogan. Another sort of un-PC slogan. Smoking, it sells itself. Yeah. You're not actually promoting it, are you?
You think that might be a loophole around the advertising regulations? If you just said, this is the cigarette selling itself, it's not us, the manufacturers.
On that note, we're going to have to leave it there. But Jeff, thanks so much for your time. And everyone should go and get tickets to his Work in Progress shows. You say to your website, Live Nation, where people can find all that?
So Live Nation would be the best place to go. Just search Jeff Norcott and obviously give us a follow on social media. I can guarantee I'll be wanging on about live dates probably for the next year and a half.
Brilliant. Well, Jeff, Chris, thank you very much. And we'll see you talk to our listeners again in the new year.
And Merry Christmas, everybody.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.